Marbada Samija ta' Campus FM, Emanuel Buttigieġ il-għakom għal-episodju wieħor ta' Taħdita' Klio. Fin-nuqqas tal-ijem, minix waħdi għaliex l-lum għandi pajaj pala mistieden lil-Dr. Anton Caruana Galizia, li huwa lecturer fl-istorja at Newcastle University. Jina għandon inna nafu xulxin numru ta' snin, going back għal meta konna undergraduates, u l-lum għu pieċir kbir li u għal-mistieden tagħna fej ħankunu għeddin nitkellmu dwar parti mir-riċerka tiegħu mod speċifiku dwar il-Baruni De Piro u il-ħidma tiegħu, il-vjaġġi tiegħu, l-esperjenza tiegħu fis-qallija fis-seklu 18 primarjament. Dal-episodju ħajkun bl-Ingliż. Anton, welcome. It's a great pleasure to be able to host you here, so thank you for accepting our invitation.
Oh, likewise, Manuel, thank you for inviting me onto your program. It's great.
So shall we start off with the protagonist of our discussion, Baron De Piro? Who are we talking of exactly, and what time frame are we looking at?
Well, yes, so it is useful to begin with a little sort of narrative around the biography of this individual. We're talking about Giovanni Pio De Piro, that is his birth name, and he is the surviving son, the only surviving son of one Lorenzo Ubaldesco De Piro. I say surviving, I mean his mother, Giovanni's mother, died shortly after Giovanni's birth, and Lorenzo Ubaldesco raises this young man himself, and he's a very ambitious father, I mm-hmm. think it's fair to say, very ambitious for himself and for his only son. I mean, it can be quite a convoluted sort of story to tell, but if we want to sort of summarize it, what happens is Lorenzo Ubaldesco has a career as an agent of the Order of St. John, of the magistracy, and his son similarly embarks on a career. He becomes an agent of the magistracy, in particular in collecting customs duties, and he goes on to become the principal agent for the Maltese Islands, for the grain fund of the Maltese Islands in Sicily, right, in Licata, in Sicily. From there he progresses, he does very well for himself, he rises through the ranks, and he ends up as the principal secretary to Grand Master Zondadari and captain of the Grand Master's bodyguard.
Right.
So that's quite high office, yes, and he continues like that. And of course, so you could say that at that point, he's at a high point, but he's relatively young. He's married well. He's married the daughter of another very significant personage in a household in the Maltese context, the Gurgion family. So his father-in-law was similarly principal secretary to the Grand Masters. He's reasonably well off. He's accumulated quite a lot of resources, economic and financial resources, pretty much rescuing his own household, the De Piro household, from penury, from, you know, complete bankruptcy at this point. So they're doing very well. And this is the point really where my particular research comes into it. He then embarks on a similar career, or at least has aspirations for a similar career, in the Kingdom of Sicily.
Okay. The larger neighbor to the north, as it were.
That is right, yes. What is it? 80, 90 kilometers to the north. And so he rocks up in Sicily. He shows up there, and he manages, this is the obscure part, is exactly how he manages this, but he manages to get himself sort of insinuated into the networks, the political networks that are operating in Sicily at this time. He takes on various minor royal offices until he lands a bigger one, which is the Real Secretaria di Siracusa. He becomes the principal government administrator, royal administrator for the royal finances that are gathered in the port city of Syracuse, which is on the east coast.
Sounds like he landed quite the job there.
Well, yes, and an interesting one, of course, because Syracuse is one of the main ports connecting to Valletta from Sicily. So from the port of Valletta to the port to Sicily, if you like, the nearest major one is the port of Syracuse. And this is, I mean, may be familiar with the history of Syracuse. This is the city that was founded, right, as a Greek colony in the ancient times. It's the city where Plato shows up, for example. And it's got a very, it features very prominently in the historical record.
Of course.
And it is, in its own sense, is also, remains a significant port city in Sicily right up to the 18th century, when its sort of economic position and political position is on the way, if you like. So he rocks up there. Yes,
and we're talking roughly the first half of the 18th century.
That's right. So when he sets off, it's sometime in the early 1720s. The exact year is not clear from the record, but by 1724-25, Giovanni de Piro is in Sicily, and he's doing all these marvelous things. And he's by 1730, right? He's got himself this office, right? This is a royal office. It's a position in the royal administration.
Mm-hmm.
And then he does one other interesting thing, which is he takes on, rather speculatively and ambitiously, a position which he is essentially administering. The setup is a little bit complex, but essentially he is the person responsible, or who gets the revenues from, the production of sugar from sugarcane at a place just outside the city of Avola, which is just south of Syracuse, again, just along the coast, the famous hexagonal city of Avola that had been destroyed in an earthquake previously, and it's sort of building itself. And he takes on this administration. This is a very commercial enterprise, sugar production.
Yeah.
Right? For those of our listeners who are not aware, Sicily was quite a sizable industry in sugar production, dating back to the late Middle Ages, if we're going to use that phrase. And it continues up into the 17th century when, shall we say, again, this is an instance of its fortunes are mixed. Mm. Right? There are a lot of producers who are slowly going out of business, not producing anymore. And Giovanni Pio de Piro, the Baron de Piro at this point, because we should mention he received a title from the Grand Master,
right?
One of the Maltese titles, Baron of Budak.
Mm-hmm.
In 1718. And so by this time he's there, just to recap, in Sicily at this point, we're talking about the 1730s, he's got himself as a royal administrator in Syracuse and this commercial enterprise, what we would call a commercial industrial manufacturing enterprise, which is the manufacture of sugar from sugarcane in Avola. So that's quite a run through.
Right, so let's start unpacking a little bit here. He starts off as a nobleman, right? He is already born into the nobility, and or is that something that he himself acquires for the family?
So that's another part of the story that we should bring in. As I said, this is an ambitious group of people. Lorenzo Valdesco, his father, and Giovanni Pio, they are ambitious, they are driven individuals, and they're highly aspirational, if we can use that phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And they are not originally members of the nobility. They are not titled. They are not of noble status,
right,
in any way recognized. This is something that they acquire through service to the Grand Masters. And it is interesting, in fact, because when the title is conferred on them, this title, Baron of Budak, they are given the use of the title, not of the fief, it should be remembered here. This is in the gift of the Grand Master, under the terms of the transfer of the Maltese Islands to the magistracy, right?
Mm-hmm.
They nominate people to the title here. And at that time, Giovanni Pio is actually away. He's in Sicily, or possibly even in Rome at the time. But the title is conferred on him,
mm-hmm.
but it's his father, Lorenzo, who shows up as a stand-in at the ceremony in which the title is conferred.
Oh, right.
So I thought that's an interesting little anecdote. So who is actually getting the title? Yes, the name goes, of course, to Giovanni Pio de Piro. He's the first Baron of Budak. But interestingly, and I think importantly, and it's a telling anecdote, is that it is Lorenzo Valdesco, who is a clergyman at this time. He's a chaplain of the Order of St. John.
Okay.
And he shows up, and the title is conferred on the family in his presence. So he's the one who takes the place of his son at the actual ceremony. It's interesting. Like it is interesting. It's like, you know, you show up for your degree, but it's, I don't know, one of your parents who goes up and collects the degree certificate for you.
Everyone is basking in an element of the glory there, no?
Indeed, yes, indeed. And so that's the very much the Malta side of that particular story, yes, in terms of the noble title.
And then this aspect of the interest in commercial activities, you know, the perhaps the stereotype we tend to hold, although I think this at least partially justified, is that the nobility does not engage in business. But the case of Giovanni Pio and the case of many others across Europe, in fact, show that the situation is more nuanced than that.
Yes, it is. I mean, sure, that description that the nobility did not involve themselves directly in what they would call commerce or manufacture or industry or any side of enterprise and business in that respect, that is mostly true, but that does not mean that even the grandest aristocratic households did not have some kind of commercial interests, maybe even from the exploitation of resources in their own lands. Right. So in the case of Sicily, for example, you had grain supplies. You had mineral extraction. So the extraction of minerals from various parts of the landscape in Sicily. And in other places, you'd have, notably in France, wine production, the production of wine from estates. Yeah? Mm-hmm. And timber production is another one that you get these noble households are involved in. So they're collecting the revenues. They don't necessarily do it themselves, but they actually own the land or the spaces, if you like, parts of the landscape where this occurs.
Right.
So they're involved in that sense. And they're also involved in financing. I mean, very, not as we would understand it today, but in financial instruments. And they do this, of course, by pooling resources in various sort of, their companionships, right? They're around the various confraternities, for example, in which they all contribute sums of money that are then essentially used as banks to make loans. Right. So there's this complex financial infrastructure in place that is very localized, very much at the micro level. And I should say that the Epiro are involved in that very much as well.
Oh, okay.
Very much.
So in a way, they, as a family, they understand the importance of making themselves indispensable to the ruling caste, as it were, of Malta, but they're also somehow extending that into Sicily, which is impressive in itself, isn't it?
Yeah. So one of the challenges here is to try and figure out exactly how representative this story is that we're describing, and I'm not quite sure we're in a position. We don't have enough data. We don't have enough examples to compare across with. But I wouldn't be surprised if there are other examples. Perhaps we don't necessarily have the records for them. But it's certain, I mean, one of the things you get from looking through the material, the archival material related to the DePiro household in the 18th century, is precisely these little references to other individuals who are quite clearly originated in Malta. Right. So part of their story is their connection with the Maltese islands. But they are in and around parts of Sicily, either as ship's captains, either as clergymen, as agents of some kind or another. And they all sort of, they somehow cross paths every now and then. There are references to other noble households, for example, the Testaferrata household at the time, also active in Sicily in some way that is not necessarily very clear from the records relating to the DePiro family, but there's certainly operating.
So clearly there's more work to be done there as well.
Well, there is indeed, yes.
Anton, you were able to share with me and through me, in a sense, our audience through Facebook can also see this really wonderful portrait depicting Gio Pio DePiro. So I remind our audience that they can see this reproduction of this on the Facebook page of the Department of History and Campus FM itself. We see this rather handsome individual in his black overcoat, clearly some lovely lace on his sleeves and around his neck, this big wig, very 18th century looking. Yeah. He's holding what seems like a letter in one of his hands. There's a mountain in the background, which I'm assuming is Etna, but now you'll tell us. So maybe we'll talk a bit about that. What is going on with this? What is he trying to tell his viewers down to today, effectively, when we look at this work of art?
Yeah, it's a very interesting image. And I mean, you've described the elements of it very well. We shouldn't forget that you can see, sort of peeking out from his dark overcoat, there's a hint of a gold waistcoat there with the buttons. And of he's got a cravat, the height of French fashion.
Yeah.
Right? Very much, this is where we get ties from, right? The cravat, an item of clothing pioneered by the court of Louis XIV, Versailles. So there we are. And he's also, interestingly, got a sword. There's a hint at the bottom right-hand corner. There's a sword hilt. Yep. He's got, yes, his arm, his hand resting on a table. He's holding what we can assume might be a letter, for example. And yes, in the background. Now, the background is also interesting. There is, yes, the mountain in the distance, right? If you're looking at it, the perspective suggests the hints at a connection with Sicily, because that would be Mount Etna. And in slightly in the foreground of that, there is like a bay in which you can make out like a peninsula or an island.
Yep.
And that, I mean, again, we're not 100% sure of a ground on this, but that could be the island of Ortigia, which is, of course, part of the city of Syracuse. That's the port of Syracuse.
Yes, yes.
So, yes, this is an individual advertising his connections to Sicily. And interesting, well, depends who the original audience for this would have been. It might have been Sicilians themselves, so they would recognize these landmarks. But certainly for someone, a Maltese person viewing this, who had knowledge, right, would be able to tell these things as well. So here is a nobleman. He carries a sword. But he is a man entrusted, a man who is trusted. He has correspondence with individuals of some importance here. So he's a man of letters, literally of letters. There are thousands of letters in the DePiero archive that are testimony to this. Is a great letter writer, or rather he has people writing the letters for him, it would seem, because he has lots of clerks. And this, you'd note the connection to Sicily and to the island of Ortigia, to Syracuse. And so this is him, if you like, in his best profile, right? It was an image for Instagram.
True.
His best profile. There you go. And you see how many likes he gets.
It does show him at, I suppose, the peak of his life, career, power, and all that. You referred just a moment ago to the DePiero archive, and that was going to be my next question. In fact, sources. So how have you gone about studying this character, this family? Where are the sources? What kind of sources are we looking at?
Yeah, indeed. So it's good to have this question. Is that some of your listeners may be aware of Casa Rocca Piccola, which is a small sort of family-run museum heritage site in Valletta, in Republic Street, Valletta, just past downhill from the Grand Master's Palace. It is still the home of the DePiero family today. They have opened up some of their collections, which sort of beyond 18th century goes in into the early 20th. Interesting.
And we should say it's a lovely place to visit, so we would encourage everyone to do so.
It is indeed. There's so many interesting aspects to it, so much to see and to discover. Part of this, of course, is their family archive, right, that I became acquainted with really after I finished my undergraduate degree at the University of Malta, because I acted as a tour guide there for a number of months.
Okay.
And that's how I got to know about the archive, and it began sort of surreptitiously, just between you and me and everyone else listening, leafing through parts of it. And of course, the contents are fascinating, really fascinating, because you wouldn't really, it's a story, if you like, that had not been sufficiently told, the full extent of it. But it should say that a lot of the work in organizing the archive was done by someone who was an MA student in history and archival studies at the University of Malta, Sara Iacchini, and credit should go to her especially for organizing and producing an initial survey of the contents. And that's where you begin to read through her, the report she drew up. You see just how rich the source material is. And particularly intriguing when I got to the bit in where she wrote in her own master's dissertation, her own dissertation about the connections with Sicily, because I thought, oh, wow,
right,
this is really something worth going into. So that's where it is. And I think recently parts of it have been digitized as part of the, what is it, the project by the Malta Study Center.
Yes, I was going to mention the fact that most of it, I think, has been digitized by the Malta Study Center. And it can be accessed online on their platform, vhmml.org. So I would encourage our audience also to go there. We've mentioned this a number of times in previous episodes. It's a wonderful resource, accessible for wherever you are. So that's
an excellent job and a really excellent resource. That is.
What is the nature of these sources? Is it mainly letters that we're looking at, or maybe even inventories, diaries? I don't know. Anything like that?
No diaries, unfortunately. But the range of material is really quite extraordinary. Yes, there's a lot of letters. There's a whole range of correspondence, and it's lots of different types. There's correspondence with family members, with relatives, correspondence from Giovanni Pio de Piro's children, for example, who some of them go off to Rome, for example, or to parts of to France to have their education and things like that. So you've got letters of that kind. Some of them can be quite revealing of sort of family dynamics and relationships. That's one aspect.
Right.
You have letters then from lots of agents everywhere, right? So those are the business ones, the ones that relate to the commercial interests, which are very varied, including the ones in Sicily. Mm-hmm. Lots of stuff on sugar, for example, sugar production. And then you have legal records. Right. So this is, you can imagine, there's a whole legal apparatus around this. There are lots of lawyers and notaries involved, recording contracts, purchases, sales, transactions, and naturally wills and entails. Right. So how family patrimony and these economic assets are passed down between generations.
Of course, yes. That is always a core element for a noble family, how they organize the transition of the title and the wealth through generations, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Any insights into the women of the family? Because it does seem like a very male story.
It does, and it is true that most of the documents are produced by men, and this explains why women, you have to, are not such a big presence. But there are references to them. There's interesting references about female education, for example, in which one of Giovanni Pio's granddaughters, for example, is educated at a convent in Malta, and she takes acting lessons.
Right.
And she plays the part of an ambassador in a play, for example. There's a wonderful little anecdote right there.
How interesting.
And, of course, one of the things I should say is that in Sicily, the De Piero married their children into members of the Sicilian nobility.
Right.
So there are letters then from the sons-in-law to Giovanni Pio De Piero. And in the postscript at the end, you'll see in a very elegant hand, the daughter writing, "Dear father, I find that I am well. I trust you are, you know," sort of little pleasantries. But they were obviously literate, so they knew their letters.
Right.
And it is in a different hand, so I think it's safe to assume that it is by the person whose signature is then at the end of the postscript.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. So they're writing as a postscript to the husband's letter, but not their actual letters.
Yes, to the husband or even to the agent who happens to be writing for them in relation to whatever business matter it is. Yes. That is the case.
Keeping a close eye on them.
Indeed. Well, indeed, yes.
We're nearing the end of our interview, Anton. How do you see this research developing? Where would you like to take it further, yourself or other venues of research that you think are doable from this archive?
Well, there are any number of topics that remain to be explored using the material in the archive itself and associated fonts, so you have to link it up. And I suppose the reflection that I would offer that really comes out strongly, I think, from the research I was able to do is that just the opportunities that are available, right, to historians who are researching material that may be housed or maybe originated in the Maltese Islands. So, you know, our various government archives and even private archives.
Mm-hmm.
And using those not only to tell histories, these little narratives about the past that pertain solely to the Maltese Islands, but to venture further afield.
Right.
These are very entangled stories we're telling, right? Mm. There are lots of connections going off everywhere. The De Piro archive makes connections with Madrid, Vienna, Rome, Paris, all these wonderful places, not to mention up and down the Italian peninsula. So they end up being sort of representative nodes in these ties, mm. right, that bring together lots of different stories that sort of collide.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Well, and
I think you've put it really, really wonderfully there. These stories that collide, and when they collide, there's so much that gets revealed to us if we are
yes,
careful
indeed, yeah.
and look for it. Well, Anton, thank you so much. That was a really wonderful tour de force through the fascinating story of Giopio De Piro and his family. And of course, our audience can learn more by looking up your own research on the subject, which is available online, and I would heartily recommend that they do so. Thank you again for accepting our invitation.
Thank you very much. You're very kind. It's a pleasure.
Ez iszemjata Campus FM, grazzi tal-konto maħna, jien Emmanuel Buttigieġ, nirringrazzjakom u nintaqgħu l-ġimgħa dieħla għall-episodju ieħor ta' Taħdita Klio.